to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program, Very Remote. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, June 1st, 2021. The Anglican Bishop of Kajukeji Diocese says some pastoralists from Jonglei State attacked residents in Kajukeji County.
These people came well-armed, about three of them, and then one of them has a uniform, military uniform.
And a veteran South Sudanese politician says the parties involved in the writing of a permanent constitution for South Sudan should consult widely.
I would call on the parties, of course, to take this thing serious and work, you know, towards in a honest and genuine way, like that, putting the interests of our people at the top of their thinking rather than their positions in power.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Anglican Bishop of Kajukeji Diocese is accusing some armed cattle keepers believed to have come from Jonglei State of attacking villages in Lire Payam last week. Right Reverend Emmanuel Murier Modi says the armed men looted money and stole personal items from the villagers at gunpoint. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
Right Reverend Emmanuel Murie Modi, Bishop of Kajukeji Diocese of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, says he had gone for a pastoral mission to Lire Parish on Sunday when the attack occurred. Bishop Murie says the armed men, one of whom wore a military uniform, beat up villagers, forcing them to flee to a nearby church where a Sunday service was ongoing.
Suddenly, when we were in the church singing, then a group of armed people intervened, came in and chased a person, and people outside who were preparing meal, they ran into the church. So these people came well armed, about three of them, and then one of them has a uniform, military uniform. So we discovered that these are group of people who have come to loot two shops. So they have looted those shops. All the properties were taken, and the other one, 108,000 South Sudanese pounds, was also looted.
Moria says when he walked outside, an armed man cocked his gun and wanted to shoot him, but he talked to him in a firm voice and convinced him to stop. He says the gunmen then ran to a nearby village where they beat up people with sticks and pangas and looted more homes.
They went and looted somebody, they took 18,000 and then vandalized things inside there. The other family, the owner is a widow, the husband has died, and they took also two solars of that lady, batteries and the inverters. They moved to the third family where they also took some blankets, clothing, and other things. And then the fourth family, they also went, and then they took solars and batteries. And they were about to rape a lady of 14 years, but this lady ran.
Murie says when the gunmen left, he immediately called the military commander in Kajukeji, who arrived with a military force at the church compound within minutes. He says no one was apprehended after the soldiers went to the village to hunt for the attackers, but he is happy the cattle keepers were ordered to leave.
They reached to amicable solution resolution. And he urged these people to leave immediately today, 1st of June. And indeed, this morning, we hear the sound of animals moving. And I was told, when I called the chief, I was told that they have already left. So this was the situation. It was very terrible. And it causes a lot of panic to the people of Kajukeji.
Murie says the Kajukeji community are mostly farmers and should be respected the same way that they respect other people's land. He says people should realize that areas like Kajukeji can grow vegetables and other foodstuffs which can be sold in Bor and other areas, while cattle keepers in Bor can produce milk and meat and sell those items to farming communities. Murie urges church leaders in Bor to continue preaching peace to the people in Bor so that armed men from that community stop attacking other people. Military spokesperson Brigadier General Lul Rai Kong says he is not aware of the incident at Kajukeji, but says he will contact commanders on the ground to determine what happened. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Some residents and traders in the northern Bahr al-Ghazal state capital, Awil, are complaining about the presence of street children loitering in the town. Some of the residents say the state Ministry of Social Welfare should reintegrate the children back into their homes. For VOA News, Hoa Kot Ho has more from Awil.
Children can be seen roaming the streets of Awil. Some of them look unwell or exhausted, while others walk around with open wounds on their bodies. The residents here say many of the children are engaged in criminal activity, including stealing from shops around town. Bolduda Kot is a trader in Awil town.
Street children, they have problems. They have great effect in the community. They devolve the crimes, like in Awil now. The practice, the evil crimes, they do kill the people, and they mobilize the young children to join them, and they leave the school by, which result into the disaster to the community, because they will kill the people, frustration will increase, and the poverty, of course, will increase, and even the rape and robberies. These are the effects to the community.
Another Awil resident, Akol Manot, who sells groceries in town, says the problem of street children in Awil should not lead to a blame game between parents and government. Manot says the government needs to address the problem straight away and reintegrate the children into their communities. Manot is calling on the government to work with aid agencies to address the matter.
The situation that I see to the children who are running from their house, so they need just to be controlled. They need to see if there is panic. So they need to see to control them. Then you feed them, then you teach them. Then I think these children will not even just go and steal. Man, the government and Fadna Chiboso, yeah, should do that one.
15-year-old Samuel says he had been asking his father to take him to school.
My mother died and my father was unable to handle us. My father's sister took me with her, but as a child, I used to make a mistake like breaking the utensil or radio. When she saw that, she would beat me. I decided to report it to my grandmother, who took me with my younger sister, and we live and cultivate, but unfortunately, the crop never produced well. So I decided to come to town.
42-year-old parent Mary Alwell says taking care of street children should be a collective responsibility for parents, the community, and the government.
Most of these street children do not have fathers. Their mother are poor. Some are selling wood, for example. If the others is left behind by a husband and she has three or more children and she has no property, then it can be difficult to take care of them. There is need for a strong cooperation to help the children by give them feeding.
Most residents in Awil blame the Social Welfare Ministry for doing little to tackle the issue of street children. Kaku Lucia Alessio, the Northern Bahr al-Ghazal State Minister for Social Welfare, says her ministry is working with aid agencies to find a solution to the problem of street children in Awil town. The minister also asks parents to play a positive role in the lives of their children to ensure they do not end up on the streets.
You marry so many wives, you produce children, but you don't have food to give them. So because of hunger, they find themselves in the street. I'm with the view of trying to come up with a plan that I will sit down with my governor, and then we have to come up with an idea, because I'm thinking we should have a place out of the town and take all of them, put them there. And then we try to find out whether the partners together, we can make school and then hospital.
The international aid agencies, Save the Children and UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, did not respond to requests for comment on the flight of street children in Awil. For VOA News, I'm Ho Akodo in Awil.
A veteran South Sudanese politician is urging the country's leaders to consider the interests of their citizens during the drafting of a permanent constitution for South Sudan. Peter Aduok Nyaba says the writing of a permanent constitution is long overdue and the parties involved should consult widely. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Peter Aduok Nyaba says, although the constitution-making process began much later than they agreed to time frame in the revitalized peace agreement, the parties should handle the process well lest it leads to a collapse of the peace deal.
I would call on the parties, of course, to take this thing serious and work, you know, towards in a honest and genuine way, like that, putting the interests of our people at the top of their thinking rather than their positions in power.
The peace agreement states that work on the permanent constitution should start 4 months after formation of the unity government and is expected to last 2 years. Article 6 requires the government to initiate a constitution-making process during the transitional period. It says a workshop that brings together all parties to the peace deal be convened by the revitalized Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission to agree on a set of procedures for drafting the permanent constitution. This is the first time South Sudanese leaders are drafting a constitution to replace the transitional constitution adopted in 2011 when the country seceded from Sudan. When the process was launched last week, President Salva Kiir promised to ensure a free process.
South Sudan nationalism must be supreme and cardinal in the permanent constitution of South Sudan.
The process is being facilitated by the German-based Max Planck Foundation for International Peace and a Rule of Law, an institute renowned internationally for writing constitutions. The workshop's guest of honor, Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok, said the process should be a chance for citizens to address the country's unresolved problems.
It has to address the aspirations of the people, aspirations of people of South Sudan, addressing issues of unity, development, and more than that, building a modern state that all the Sudanese people will be, and particularly South Sudanese, proud of.
The exercise brought together representatives of all signatories to the peace deal. General Charles Tai Gitwai is the interim chairperson of the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the oversight body established to track the peace deal's implementation.
This process requires a lot of political, technical, financial, and logistic support, and therefore like to appeal to Arctic regional grantors and international partners and friends of South Sudan to fully support this process.
Oyet Nathaniel Pierino, a delegate of Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, says the process should include reducing the president's powers.
The powers given to the president is unacceptable. It's a sweeping powers, so we expect people to regain back their powers in the new constitution, to exercise their powers through their elected representatives or directly in a referendum.
Clement Bugoniwia is a representative of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance who also attended the conference.
So I want to see, first of all, inclusivity. So I want to see that no single group dominates the process, so that the aspiration of the people of South Sudan and all of us is reflected in the constitution. What is important for us is everyone should see himself in that process. The previous constitution has not been like that.
Once the permanent constitution is completed, it is expected to guide the conduct of elections, guarantee good governance, and protect human rights. Following the 3-day workshop, the process will include revamping the Constitutional Review Commission, appointing a subcommittee to convene the National Constitutional Conference, and implementing the workshops agreed to recommendations. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, what are the dangers of smoking during the COVID-19 pandemic? Find out more after this break.
do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you do when you are in a bad mood?
I usually would move away from the environment of the agitation and then get a quiet place and pray. Usually when I'm done praying, the agitation and the stress, I get some amount of relief.
Sometimes I decide to sleep and maybe read a novel that can make my mind come like back to normal. Yeah, that's what I normally do.
I rather stay alone and I listen to music, uplifting music, music that has good lyrics that would uplift my spirit.
Okay, when I'm in the bad mood, sometimes I play video games just to make me feel happy.
Actually, I call mom, I talk to her, tell her what's disturbing me, she advises me, then it's a done deal.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. And in our Tuesday health segment, we'll look at the dangers of smoking during COVID-19 pandemic. In marking World No Tobacco Day, the World Health Organization is urging smokers to quit their habit, warning they are at higher risk of dying from COVID-19 than non-smokers. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Head of WHO's Tobacco Control Program, Vinayak Prasad, tells VOA a plethora of scientific studies over the past year confirm smokers face a 50% higher risk of developing severe disease and death from COVID-19.
It's logical because smoking does compromise on the lung function, and this virus does attack the lungs. So that's where the rationale for taking measures to not use tobacco.
The World Health Organization is urging smokers to join its year-long Quit Tobacco campaign, which helps countries scale up their tobacco control services. These include running national awareness campaigns, opening new cessation clinics, and offering nicotine replacement therapies. Prasad says it is of utmost importance to make users aware of the risks they run. He says some 8 million people will die prematurely this year from tobacco-related illness, such as cancers, heart disease, and respiratory illnesses. Most of these deaths will occur in low-income countries. He notes it usually takes decades for these deadly illnesses to develop. Therefore, preventing young people from taking up this habit is essential, as they can lead to a lifelong addiction. He accuses the tobacco industry of targeting young people to get them hooked on their products by offering freebies such as tickets to concerts, nicotine pouches and e-cigarettes. This, he says, has been met with success in many countries. For example, he notes 38% of Indonesia's teenage boys smoke.
Likewise, in European setting, for example, the girls, the women, tobacco use is so high that the male-to-female difference is no longer there. But the industry is continuing to reap all of the benefits they can from this divide, getting more and more women and targeting the girl child, adolescents, and then continuing to push their products in developing countries.
WHO reports imposing substantial taxes on tobacco products is one of the most effective ways of getting smokers to quit. Other successful smoke reduction measures include a ban on advertisements and promotions, health warnings on tobacco products, and designating areas as smoke-free zones. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on COVID, record numbers of COVID-19 vaccinations have been completed in Australia as a snap 7-day lockdown continues in the nation's second populous state. 7 million people in Victoria are subject to strict stay-at-home orders after a growing cluster of infections was detected in recent days. Australia has managed to mostly contain the coronavirus through lockdowns, the closure of international borders, and strict quarantine measures for returning citizens. But the national vaccination program has been affected by supply issues and hesitancy among many Australians. From Sydney, Phil Master reports.
There are estimated to be 100 active coronavirus cases in Australia, according to the Health Department. About half are in Victoria, which is under a 7-day lockdown. It's the state's fourth shutdown since the pandemic began. The number of infections in Australia is small compared to other countries, including Japan, Brazil, and the United States. However, community transmission of the virus has been rare in recent months, and the outbreak in Victoria is significant. There's been complacency in the community and mounting hesitancy about vaccines and possible side effects, which have delayed the national inoculation plan. Health authorities in Victoria, though, have said the lockdown has sent residents flocking to injection centres across the country in record numbers. However, some experts believe that it might be too late to prevent another wave of infections in Australia's second most populous state. Dr. Michelle Ananda-Raja is an infectious diseases expert at Melbourne's Alfred Hospital.
We've been here before. I think, though, that the stakes are higher this time because we have all the factors for what is essentially a perfect storm. We have a largely unvaccinated population. We have winter approaching and we have an unforgiving variant on the loose at the moment. You know, Victoria is primed at the moment for a third wave, and we need to do everything possible to prevent that from happening.
Melbourne, the Victoria state capital, endured Australia's longest COVID-19 lockdown last year. Once again, the nation's second biggest city finds itself under tight restrictions. Masks are now mandatory. Places of worship and schools are closed. Victorians can only leave home for essential work, shopping, exercise, caregiving, or to get a coronavirus vaccine. Businesses are facing heavy losses. A man infected with a highly contagious COVID-19 variant, who stayed at a quarantine hotel for returning travellers, is thought to be the source of the outbreak. Australia has recorded just over 30,000 coronavirus cases and 910 deaths since the pandemic began, according to government statistics. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Cameroon rights groups, opposition parties and local media are asking the government to publish its findings after most of a $335 million loan from the IMF could not be accounted for. At least 15 officials have appeared before commissions of investigations. For VOA News, Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
A government statement read on Cameroon state media Monday calls on civilians to be calm as investigations on missing funds continue. The statement from government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi states that justice will take its course. The statement comes after Cameroon rights groups and opposition asked the government to explain what happened to about $335 million loaned by the International Monetary Fund to fight COVID-19. Cameroon says within the past 1 week, 15 ministers have appeared at the audit bench of the Supreme Court and a special criminal tribunal to account for the funds. Joseph Lavoisier Tapi is legal advisor to the opposition Social Democratic Front Party and a member of the Cameroon Human Rights League.
Déjà, je voudrais relever que les ministres n'ont aucune immunité.
Tapi says the Cameroon Special Criminal Tribunal should have ordered their arrest after the audit bench of the Supreme Court found out that some ministers stole COVID-19 funds. He says the money should have been invested to save lives and assist suffering people. He says he wants to make it clear that government ministers in Cameroon do not have immunity like lawmakers. In June 2020, SDF lawmakers complained that the awarding of COVID-19 contracts did not respect procurement procedures and gave room for massive corruption. Local media like Equinox Radio and TV, Royal FM, reported gross cases of embezzlement. In one case, the Ministry of Scientific Research received $9 million to produce the drug chloroquine. The ministry instead bought chloroquine amounting to 30% of the funds from China. Other cases involve overbilling and failure to render service or provide supplies after payment. Andre Luther Mecca speaks for the ruling CPDM party, to which all of the ministers called up for questioning belong.
On ne peut pas d'ores et déjà avoir des sentences et des verdicts.
Mecca says Cameroonians should stop asking for ministers to either be punished or to refund COVID-19 funds. He says Cameroon considers all suspects innocent until found guilty by the law courts. He says Cameroon President Paul Biya has a strong political will to punish everyone who has either mismanaged, embezzled, or siphoned state money. Angelbert Lebon is a member of the Cameroon Civil Society. He says President Biya should explain to the Cameroonian people how his government has managed the COVID-19 funds.
Depuis le début de cette pandémie, il est où, Monsieur Biya, pendant que son peuple meurt?
He says Biya should for once speak out against embezzlement and publicly condemn his collaborators who have stolen COVID-19 funds. He says Cameroon has more serious life-threatening issues to handle than the heavily publicized receptions Biya gives diplomats in his office. Last month, Human Rights Watch urged the IMF to ask Cameroon to ensure independent and credible inquiry on the management of COVID-19 funds before approving a third loan. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in Cameroon in March 2020, the IMF has approved two emergency loans to the Central African state, totaling $382 million. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
We'd love to hear what you think about this program. Our WhatsApp number is +12026308011. We'll air your comments every Friday. We now leave you with a beautiful melody from Uganda. We have been listening to that nice melody from Uganda. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers, because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.